investing based on non-financial information, is it a good idea or is it just a bunch of malarkey? We have a special guest on the show today that's going to talk about this coming up next.
From the streets of San Antonio straight to your wallet, it's Jake's Two Cents on Jake of All Trades.
All right, welcome back. My name is Kirk and I'm not a financial expert.
But I'm Jake Rivas. I am the financial expert. But together, Kirk and I talk about financial planning topics, we discuss the economy, and we look at financial tools, all with the express purpose of helping our listeners build wealth both today and into the future.
All right. So while I'm bringing on our guest, why don't you introduce our guest, and I will actually bring him on right now.
I'm super excited because the guest we have today is Kevin Moore, and Kevin is actually the principal advisor of our firm, iFinancial, that we talk about on the show all the time. Welcome, Kevin, and thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Great.
So thank you. Kevin, also, in addition to being the principal financial advisor, he used to manage mutual funds back in the day. So Kevin is an expert in a lot of different areas, which is why we wanted to have him on this show in particular, because today we're going to be talking about something that we've talked about on a show previously, which is called ESG investing, or investing according to your values. I think that was the title of the show we did previously. And this is a pretty hot topic that is continuing to be in the top of the headlines. And Kevin has a lot of expertise when it comes to managing mutual funds specifically. And because this is a component of how you evaluate or screen your investment decision making, we thought Kevin would be an excellent expert to come talk to us about what is ESG investing and why should we care. So Kevin, first, can you just talk about like what is it that we're talking about here?
Sure. So ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. And to your point, Jake, earlier about incorporating those in the investment decision, it revolves, or the practice of ESG investing involves incorporating the company's impact on the environment, the company's social engagement, and the company's governance practice as part of the evaluation process that we would use to determine whether or not to invest in a company or to sell the stock of a company.
And that's much different than like it used to be, right? So when you would manage mutual funds in the past, were those variables that you looked at when you were selecting companies or not?
No, this is really something that, while has been around for probably 20 years, has really only come to the forefront within the last, say, 3 or 4 years, when there's been this massive proliferation of investment vehicles, whether in mutual fund forms or exchange-traded fund ETF forms, focused exclusively on or primarily on ESG topics and ESG screening methods.
So just so I understand, when we talked about this, Jake, last time, so it was a while back, and basically, if I remember correctly, the idea was when we would invest, if I invest as a person, just a normal person saying, here's my money, invest in whatever will give me the most money, basically, back, right? That's the prime directive in the past. Is that correct?
In the past. Correct. Yeah. Well, one of the major objectives is obviously I'm buying an investment to grow my wealth.
Yeah.
Whether or not the company does right by the country, right, through policy, or whether they do the right things for the climate is sort of irrelevant, or that's the way it used to be. And so what we're talking about now is that moves up to the forefront as more of an important decision maker.
What is that?
To whether or not I'm going to invest in that.
The ESG thing. Yeah. So in other words, the things you guys were just talking about what they, so if I understand, it's what they're doing for the environment, what they're doing for, what was the S again?
Social.
Social, and then governance. And so governance is different than government, right? So it's how they govern their people and the people that interact with them. Is that what that means?
No, what it really refers to is really, has three components to it. Number one, their board of directors. Is their board of directors a diverse group of individuals?
Okay.
Secondly, is the way in which that they run the company, how transparent is the company with regards to its financials, with regards to its policies, not only with the employees, but with the public at large? And lastly, it's a question of does the company have policies internally that promote diversity, promote inclusion, promote tolerance within the company itself?
Okay. So that's the governance component. And then, so how is that different than the social component, I guess?
So the social component would be focusing on do they, with regards to their suppliers, for example, do their suppliers employ child labor? Do their employers have, how diverse are they, or how supportive are they of a diverse workforce? Do they pay their employees a family, a living wage, for example? So looking at sort of a social approach to not only their own company, but to their suppliers as well.
Okay. So if I understand it, it seems like there's a little bit of overlap between social and governance, but the idea is that social is suppliers and people related to the company, like what Apple does in foreign countries, for instance, might be an example. And do they employ, you know, sweatshops or whatever it might be? And I don't know if they do or not, and rumors, I'm not going to get into that. But like, if they did, that would be a problem for the S, social, versus governance would be like, are they paying, you know, all their employees a living wage type thing? Or am I mixing that up?
Yes. In fact, if we use a very current example, you may have heard in the news within the last month or so, as a result of some, and this is being an example of the S component of this, in Georgia, the governor signed a bill that was interpreted by many to be extraordinarily restrictive with regards to access to voting. And Major League Baseball, as well as a number of other companies that are both based in Georgia, but as well as outside of Georgia, have decided to either move, in the case of Major League Baseball, they moved the All-Star game from Atlanta as a result of this legislation being enacted. And many other companies have decided that they would not hold maybe national sales events or other corporate events in the state of Georgia as a state of protest. And that's being, that's a very good example of the S aspect of ESG as well.
Got it.
So I've been thinking about this a lot, obviously, and it kind of popped into my head here recently because I read this article that was talking about the expansion of next-gen investors, especially in the last couple of years. Do you think there's a correlation between younger investors entering the markets and this rise in attention to ESG factors when it comes to selecting investments?
I do, because we have a bunch of new investors. These are new investors coming into the world of investing. And as with every generation, they bring their own focus, they bring their own interests. And it is without a doubt that for next gen individuals, whether they are investors or not, survey after survey, poll after poll, their top issue, or if not their top, certainly in their top three, is climate change. And so when we think about them as investors, the E in ESG is environment. And so I think there's driving a great deal of that is next gen's concerns about the environment.
Interesting. That's, yeah. I mean, I kind of thought there was probably a correlation there. So is this all smoke and mirrors, or is there some legitimacy to screening an investment from this perspective?
Well, that is literally the $64 trillion question. And a large part of that comes down to how you wish to operationalize, if you will, or put into place your ESG focus. So if we think in broad terms, the way ESG used to be, and you alluded to this earlier, Jake, as investing with your values, it used to be called socially responsible investing back when this first got started in the late 90s. And it has now evolved to ESG. But the first decision that investors have to make is whether or not they wish to apply these standards in an inclusionary way or in an exclusionary way. And by that, I mean that do we want to engage in, we want to invest in companies, let's say oil companies, because we believe that the only way that we can force oil companies or energy companies in general to be more conscious of their stewardship of the earth is by being shareholders so that they will listen to us. Or do we want to take the approach that we are not going to invest in energy companies because we do not want any of our investment dollars to be involved in anything that is potentially detrimental to the client or to the climate, excuse me. So that's the first step. And from that point, whichever decision you decide to make, whether you wish to be inclusive or exclusive, is then going to open up an opportunity or an avenue for a variety of investment options to you that can be, some are going to be more effective than others. But what's really the difficulty here is that there's no set standards as to what constitutes an ESG investment, whether it's exclusionary or not exclusionary. Unlike in the accounting world, where there's a set of standards, there's a GAAP, the globally accepted accounting principles, and then each individual country has a unique variation on that. At the moment, there is no global set standards for what is good environmental policy, what is good social policy, what is good governance policy. It is really, to some extent, in the eye of the product creator as to what constitutes an ESG investment. So what do I mean by that? We could have one fund company or one EFT company that defines ESG investing as being a company that is trying to do better going forward and is a commitment to do better going forward. And we could have another product manufacturer, EFT or mutual fund company, that says, well, we want specific. So by the next 5 years, you need to have this degree of change in your environmental, your climate footprint, for example. And they're both marketed as ESG products. Is one better than the other? We don't quite know the answer to that, but the difficulty from an investor perspective is that they both have the ESG label on them. And unless you do the next level of research, it's very hard to determine, well, is this really is the investment approach really matching with what I'm trying to achieve as the investor?
Interesting. And I feel like that's also extremely difficult to measure when it comes to mutual fund investing specifically, right? Because as a mutual fund investor, we don't have direct control over the individual companies that we're owning inside of our fund. And so it's kind of up to the fund company. So if I'm picking a fund company based off of what their criteria sets as ESG, I need to really understand what their criteria is to make sure that it's flowing through in the actual acquisition of companies with my dollars. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it goes very deep into that point, because this goes back to whether we want to be inclusionary or exclusionary. So if we're exclusionary in our approach, then we're just not going to invest, continuing with the example, in energy companies, because that would be a view that energy companies have a negative impact on the climate. If we take the approach of being inclusionary, we as investors, if we identify a company that a mutual fund company or even an ETF, because an ETF is a basket of securities as well, and that they may have standards that of their ESG definitions that we agree with. But we have to go to the next level, because we agree with the mutual fund or EFT sponsor, for investors, we have an obligation to vote at annual meetings on either company-sponsored initiatives or shareholder initiatives. And so we could have two ETFs or two mutual fund product sponsors that are both inclusionary, meaning we want to, in this example, invest in oil companies. But one may decide that they, when they vote their proxy at the annual shareholder meeting to basically support the company, because that's how they feel is the best way to engage the management of the company with regards to future policy changes, or whether or not they're going to vote on the proxy initiatives at the shareholders meeting in accordance with those ESG principles. So there's yet another layer of due diligence that's required to ensure that your intended objectives are actually being met when you're investing in a pooled basket of securities, whether it's through a mutual fund or an ETF.
Now, how does this, a lot of this seems like this is what the mutual fund managers are dealing with in terms of inclusionary and exclusionary. As a normal investor, let's say, who doesn't you know, like, let's just say they're, you know, focusing on their profession. They are interested in what this stuff, you know, in terms of that it is going toward the ESG things that they believe in, but they also want to make money. Obviously, that's why they're investing. So how, you know, so for me, the question is like, does this expect more time from the average investor to be able to investigate, to see what's really going on? Whereas, you know, like when my dad was growing up, he, you know, had like a financial planner. He had like these little investments and he would just put them in there and that was it. And not, and just do his job, right? Just work all day. And so the, so I guess the question is like, what kind of expectation is now, or pressure or whatever, is put onto the end investor in terms of what they need to know, instead of just make as much money as you can for me and don't lose my money, please. Like that, that, which is usually what we want from, you know, investing. That's how I was raised with thinking about investing is, you know, obviously there's ups and downs. We've talked about that a lot on the show, but that's generally the prime directive. And I'm just curious your thoughts.
That is a really, really complex issue, because let's just take, for example, we wanted to focus. We just used examples focusing on the E of the ESG. Let's say, for example, we wanted to focus on the S part of that. That was something that was really important. We want to invest in companies that are focused on social justice issues, that are focused on inclusion and diversity, living wages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you focus on that, and that wants, you want that to be a very significant portion or a big factor in your, in the investment decision making process, it is quite likely that you're going to wind up not being able to invest in companies that have generated a tremendous amount of return. If we take, for example, the FANG stocks, the Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Those companies don't have the greatest, depending upon which set of criteria you want to use, the greatest rankings as it relates to that S portion of the equation. And in the case of Google and in Facebook, you can even argue that on the G side of things, because they have two share classes that allows the owners or the original founders of the two respective companies, Mark Zuckerberg and the two founders of Google, to be able to control the company because they own a different share class than what's available to the public. And you could make the case that actually that's not really transparent governance. If you apply those two standards, then you are not going to be investing in Facebook and Google. And if we saw over the course of the last year, if you didn't invest in Facebook and Google, your returns were going to be materially different than if you had invested in Facebook and Google. So this comes back to, Kirk, the point of investing. And this is where decisions at the investor level and what their intentions are become really important. You may have, in your example, Kirk, a strong desire to want to use your money in a socially responsible way that reflects your values. And maybe you want to do that both in your investing dollars as well as with your consumer dollars. A couple of years of perhaps mediocre returns relative to the indices that get published and talked about on an everyday basis, you may decide, well, I'd rather use my consumer dollars to only patronize companies that reflect my values, but I'm going to let my investment dollars to generate the returns that I need to meet future goals, whether it's retirement or a house or whatever it happens to be. So that's really something that needs to be done on an individual basis as to how you want to employ either your consumer dollars or your investment dollars.
So you're proposing a new category that, or it, maybe in my ignorance, I don't know if it's a new category. It's a new category to me, a category of what I basically my income and the money I make. So it's almost like I have, you know, I made, let's say in 2020, $5,000 from investments. Are you saying that I should take that or a portion of that? I mean, you're not saying to do that, but in your example, that kind of, that money that's directly from investments, I take that and use it just for ESG things for the future. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly an approach, but okay. More to the point of what I was trying to explain was, so your net, the net paycheck that gets deposited into your checking account at whatever frequency, you get to decide
my paycheck.
What you want to do with that. Your paycheck, uh-huh. Right?
Okay, so we're talking about my paycheck. So my
your
okay,
paycheck.
Got it.
So are you going to, you can, in a very, very simplistic world, if we divide those dollars into two categories, my consumer dollars, where am I going to spend my money? Am I going to go to Whole Foods or H-E-B? Am I going to buy a Prius, or am I going to buy an F-150? Or on my investment dollars, am I going to utilize ESG on my investment dollars as well, which may result in, depending upon how much weighting you want to give to the ESG criteria, result in you not investing in companies that will generate, at least we, as we have seen most starkly in the past year, significant returns. And you have to be comfortable, or you have to, A, know that going into employing an ESG screen if you're going to do an exclusionary approach versus your consumer dollars. Now, if we take the inclusionary, and Jake asked this question earlier about is it really all smoke and mirrors? So Wall Street is great at creating product, and they are great at marketing products. That's what they do. They are masters at doing that. So what Wall Street has started to offer investors over these last really 2 years is this inclusionary approach. And the way that they package it is by saying, hey, look, If we want oil companies to change, for example, they're not going to talk to us if we're not a customer or a shareholder. Mm-hmm. So you may decide on your consumer dollars that you're going to buy a Tesla, so you're not going to be a customer of an oil company. So you elect to become a shareholder so you can try to influence corporate behavior or management behavior going forward
through your vote.
Well, yeah, through your vote, right? Well, then when you start looking at, well, what's the percentage of a shareholder? How hard is it for a shareholder to actually get a proposal on the agenda for the national meeting? Well, we've seen over the last 15 years that companies have made it much harder for shareholders to get initiatives put on the agenda at the shareholders meeting. So you may not, even as a shareholder, you may not be a significant enough shareholder to be able to get
an initiative. You need major shares.
Exactly right. So then we go to the ETFs and the mutual funds. And now they're saying, as we alluded to earlier, there's no standards for what ESG stands for. And there's also no standards for how we might want to massage the ESG standards. You know, there are some fund companies out there that say, well, the best way to do this is to be large shareholders and force management and meet with management all the time and force them to do that. Well, maybe. We just haven't seen any evidence to date. But we have seen now, having said all that, BlackRock, which is the largest asset manager in the world, they manage over $5 trillion for governments and for individuals and so forth. 2 years ago, their chairman, Larry Fink, said that ESG was going to be a major component of how they chose investments around the world. And they were going to be active, because they're such large shareholders, they were going to be active not only in the promotion of shareholder initiatives, but that they were going to be much more detailed in terms of determining which particular initiatives at the general meeting they would support and not support. It's only 2 years. So we really can't say yet whether or not they've had any material impact on the course of events at the company level to become more oriented towards the environment, towards social policy, or towards improved transparency of governance.
So it's just a way for the general, it seems like it's a way for these funds that are focused on ESG to be able to have a voice in some of these companies that they normally wouldn't have if that wasn't the focus. Is that one way to look at it?
Yeah, that's absolutely one way to look at it. If we look at the amount of money that's been invested in the financial markets and it just increases every year, there is some logic to the idea that if we are shareholders then and large enough shareholders, then corporate management will pay attention to us. Remains to be seen, however, whether or not that's the case. back when I was managing mutual funds myself and was meeting with corporate management on a regular basis, they're receptive to the ideas, but like any corporate management, we know how to run our business, and our shareholders are who we're running the business for. At least that's in your mind, your example earlier, Kirk, the way your dad grew up, corporate management was supposed to run the business for the benefit of the shareholders. Well, if the benefit of the shareholders have historically defined benefit as the greatest amount of return, regardless of what it does to the employees or what it does to the environment. Increasingly, to Jake's point about next-gen investors, as next-gen investors become greater percentage of participants in the financial markets, and if they believe that corporate management has to expand their definition of serving shareholders to include a local community, to include the environment, to include social policies, then perhaps over time, those corporate management decisions will be influenced by more so by those factors than they have been in the past. We're not sure if that's the case, but that's certainly the hope. That's the goal.
So if I condensed down what you said, because I love how you framed giving power to the consumer, because I think that's often overlooked when we talk about investing and financial planning. We feel really small. And we feel like we don't have a lot of influence because we're talking about a mutual fund company that manages $5 trillion, right? Those numbers are astronomical, and my $30,000 little account is kind of meaningless. But by acknowledging the power that the consumer has at the very fundamental level, going and spending your consumer dollars, sounds to me like in the interim, that probably has the largest impact from an ESG perspective on the common person, right? The everyday individual investor, maybe more so than trying to screen a mutual fund to invest in those same type of factors, would you say?
I would agree entirely. It's a much more immediate and much more direct impact on how you use your dollars if you use it on based on what you employ ESG factors on how you spend your consumer dollars than it might be with your investment dollars. It certainly will be more immediate.
More immediate. That's really the key there too. And I think if you're listening to this too, like if you're interested in this subject matter as an investment strategy, think about where you are in your wealth accumulation phase of your financial planning journey and recognize sort of your role, right? We've talked about before on the show that like, if I'm just a participant in a 401k and I'm putting in my $50 a pay period into my plan, I don't know that my ESG investment decision-making is really all that impactful, but I still want that piece in my financial plan, right? So you could still have a narrative working through your financial plan that I have an ESG focus. It's just more so on the behavioral side, where I choose to spend my money when I go out to eat, where I choose to go and shop for groceries, all of those behavioral factors. And then you're still accomplishing the same thing at the end of the day because you're supporting something that's meaningful to you, which is kind of the objective to begin with. We can get lost in like the high level analytics of breaking down these variables of defining ESG. But at the end of the day, it's about this is important stuff to me and this is what I want my hard-earned dollars to support.
Yep, I would agree entirely.
Good stuff. Kevin, thank you for being on the show today and talking to us about this very interesting subject. I hope you enjoyed your time.
I did. My pleasure, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, guys. That wraps up this episode of Jake of All Trades. Be sure to check us out on social media by searching for @Jake's2Cents and check out the blog at jakes2cents.com. Take care. We'll see you next time.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor. Fixed insurance products and services offered through CES Insurance Agency. Actual performance and results will vary. These interviews do not constitute a recommendation as to the suitability of any investment for any person or persons having circumstances similar to those portrayed. Consult a financial advisor regarding your specific circumstances.